Hello, everybody. Welcome back to Blockchain Won't Save the World. I am here with Yuval Ruz, the CEO of Digital Asset. It's a big show today. We're talking about the newly minted, freshly announced Canton Network, what I think is one of the most ambitious blockchain and DLT projects in the world. And Yuval is going to help break it down for us, talk through the origin story, and help explain exactly what's going to happen in the next few months and weeks ahead. Yuval, how are you doing today?
Oh, I'm great. And thank you for having me, Anthony.
That's my absolute pleasure. Coming to us live from New York. It looks like it's sunny and warm there. So I hope you're enjoying a New York summer.
It is. There's no smoke from Canada today. So we're all good.
Blame Canada for that one. Glad things are well. Let's jump into a quick background. For those who don't know you, for those who don't know Digital Asset, Digital Asset's been around for a long time, a number of very significant projects in your history. For those who don't know you, give us a little quick synopsis, if that's okay.
Sure. So just real quick, my background is more front office technology. Started my career at Citadel as a developer, and then moved to DRW Trading, where I ran an ETF market making desk, and then started a venture arm of DRW, which is called DRW VC, which makes a lot of investments actually in the space. And then in 2012-13 roughly, DRW started a unit called Cumberland Mining, which is their crypto trading arm of the company. And while I was doing the investments, we started looking into investments in the space. And, you know, after a few years, realized that there is a big opportunity for many industries, but starting with financial services, to benefit from the technology, or maybe more accurately, from the ideas behind the technology. And that led to me and another person who actually started Cumberland Mining to leave DRW and to start Digital Asset.
Very good. So that's the origin story. And Digital Asset have had a number of different projects over the years. I know you're not allowed to have favorites, but any that you'd call out as examples of where digital asset technology is being used today that you're particularly proud?
Sure. I think, you know, to be honest, I think that one of the first projects that brought a lot of attention to us is the ASX. And even as of recently, I'll start there. ASX is the Australian Securities Exchange. We started a project with them on replacing all of clearing and settlement in Australia, meaning that every stock, publicly traded stock that will trade in Australia, will be managed on blockchain. Unfortunately, the project right now is at a pause until ASX decide how they want to move forward. Happy to talk about kind of my perspective on why it happened, but that's one. I'm still actually very proud of what we achieved there, because one of the things that people were very concerned with respect to the technology is, would you be able to actually meet the throughput and volumes of a publicly traded market? And I'm very happy to say that we were able to show that you could actually run one of the top 10 equity markets in the world using the technology. And there's, you know, other reasons why we are where we are, but, you know, at least I'm very happy that from a technology perspective, we achieved what we wanted to achieve. Other projects that are worth noting in the public domain, we're doing a very exciting project with the Hong Kong Stock Exchange, which should become live any day now, which is really streamlining and reducing a lot of breaks that happen when you trade between China and the rest of the world. China is a T0 settlement, the rest of the world isn't. And that mismatch in settlement creates a lot of breaks, and we're using the technology to streamline that bridge, which is called Stock Connect. We went live with Deutsche Börse on tokenization of structured products, so short-term call options. And that took the issuance process from 3 to 6 days, which is kind of a problem when you're trying to trade a one-month call option, to effectively real time. Other interesting project with Broadridge. We have, I would say that that's the closest CeFi project to DeFi. It's really automate the whole repo market in the US. Just to kind of put numbers to people, the repo market globally is about $10 trillion every single day. half of it is in the US. So about $4.5 to $5 trillion trades in the US every day. And there's a lot of opportunity to use smart contracts to automate that process, to have it more efficient. So with Broadridge, we launched a repo product, which includes three types of repos. So intra-dealer repo, when you want to collateralize your own internal or finance your own internal entities. Bilateral repo, so between two counterparties, but then also recently intraday repo. So when you don't want to just do overnight financing, but you just want to do short time frame financing, you could actually do a repo transaction for just a few hours. And it was just public that DRW and SocGen just did a 3-hour repo a few weeks ago. And I think that you're going to see that continues to grow because given interest rates where they are, being able to have much more precise financing windows is going to be a very big opportunity. Moving on, tokenization, what we're doing with Goldman, HSBC around digitizing asset classes. Happy to talk about why I don't like the word tokenization. I just generally speaking find it very misleading. So I like to talk about it digitizing asset using smart contracts, I think is a much more accurate reflection of what we do. And again, they've done a few bond issuances with those individuals, but I think you will see before this year end a very big issuance by one of our customers on one of these platforms. And, you know, so those are the things that are, you know, in the public domain. There's a few others we've done around securities financing with Equilin, but there's a bunch of others around streamlining post-trade for physical nat gas, syndicated loans, which is a massive, it's a $3.5 trillion market in the US, mortgages, so issuance of mortgages. There's a bunch of very interesting. And then we also have customers in the insurance space, and sports wagering out of all industries. But our main focus is financial services at the moment.
We've taken up already half of the show with the intro, which shows the breadth of work that you guys have been up to. And genuinely, thank you for the kind of some of the clarification points and also for coming out of the block with ASX. It's a well-known project. It was a poster child project for a long time. But I think what it shows you is that digital transformation is still hard. Whatever technology you're using, if you're replacing, lifting and shifting fundamental infrastructure, whether that's a core banking system, whether that's cross-border systems, or whether that's just cutting out something that's part of a core enterprise system, it still takes time. It's still hard. It doesn't always work. And it's not necessarily because the technology isn't fit for purpose either. There are people factors.
Hire you as our spokesman, factors. Anthony.
Well, not for nothing. I do the odd bit of marketing work from time to time. This is what the show is about. In fact, this is what I would like the industry to spend more time doing, is demystifying, clarifying, using human relatable terminology to help understand. Like the financial services, capital markets, investment banking, these are opaque and oftentimes very technical domains, in the same way that blockchain and Web3 often is. The way we use some of our terminology, the way you casually throw repo around as if everybody should know what a repo is one of those things that the rest of the world struggles to catch up with us when we explain why is digitization of assets a useful thing to do. Not because, you know, everybody assumes assets are already digital. I have it on my phone. My assets are digital, aren't they? Well, no, because there's a whole bunch of plumbing that goes on in the rest of the world that is a little bit broken, and we're trying to fix it.
It's super interesting. Yeah, it's super interesting what you're saying. My co-founder has been recently using this analogy or story, which I just think fits perfectly to what you just said, which is, you know, when he talks to clients, a lot of times he says, you know, we've been living in a DLT world for the last 60 years. And when he says that, people pause and say, what are you talking about? This is a new thing. He says, no, it's, you know, if you really just take the idea of a blockchain, is really just how do we take ledgers and come to an agreement between those ledgers? So yeah, today we're using technology to solve that. But in the last 60 years, you were just using people as your consensus mechanism, right? And that's why I keep on trying to say that really DLT in a lot of ways is not really trying to change the world. It's really trying to change the way we operate the world, right? And this idea that today when you have breaks or disagreements, you just send it to offshore teams, you know, whether it's in India, the Philippines, different locations in the world. And then you have just people creating some kind of consensus, and that consensus gets done via emails, phone calls, messages, whatever. But at the end of the day, you get to some consensus. You know, they keep on talking that proof of work is a very expensive consensus. I would say that the consensus that we run today, while not having a fully digital world, is a much more expensive consensus, right? That's the reason why offshore got created, is that running these type of tasks in developed countries was too expensive. It just kind of made businesses really not financially feasible. And when I think about DLT, all we're trying to do is say, we still need to get to consensus, because at the end of the day, we need to exchange things when things settle, and we need to have an agreement on those things. So we're just trying to short circuit that very expensive consensus mechanism to make it much more efficient, much faster. And as a result of that, improve margin, open business opportunities that today wouldn't be possible. So thank you for saying that, because I just truly agree with that sentiment.
We're going kind of going backwards to go forwards. We're going from kind of expensive people consensus to slightly cheaper people consensus to then digitization. The fun part, and this is the reference that I like to make to Singularity University, the Peter Diamandis version of this, is that once you can get away from physical manual, you can get to digitization and standardization, then you can democratize access, and then everybody can participate in building software, building applications. Okay, not always in a regulated industry, but the opportunity to reduce cost even further and transform in a bunch of different directions.
Spot on. I think the key word of what you said is the opportunity, because it's not by definition. And this is, by the way, why I don't like the word tokenization, because it implies if something exists in a token, you effectively democratize the asset. That's just not true. And I that's why I like to use the word digitization. And what you just said is, I think that if an asset was born digital, was managed digital front to back, and now I'm going to use the word you use, you create the opportunity to democratization. It doesn't necessarily mean that that is definitely what's going to happen, but I think you have created the opportunity to do that. There's many reasons why potentially a private equity firm, even if you said the marginal cost of managing another investor, would not want to open it to 10,000 investors, because they like running a private equity fund with only 50 investors. That's just kind of their business they like to operate. But I think that if you gave them the tools to fully digitize how a private equity is being managed, that the marginal cost of adding another investor or potentially another 1,000 investors did not cost them more, I think you definitely created the opportunity to democratize private equity investing, right? And I think that that's the key around tokenization, is how do we make assets, you know, highly more efficient or significantly more efficient, because that creates these opportunities. It doesn't mean that that would be the outcome. It doesn't mean that there will be more liquidity, but you have definitely created the opportunity. And that's why I like to give this example. Robinhood fractionalized shares without tokenizing anything. They fractionalized shares just because the way of trading US equities is highly digital today. It's highly efficient. That the marginal cost of letting you trade 100 shares versus 50 shares versus 10 shares is no longer significant. And therefore, allowing you to trade half a share is possible.
Great background context. And with that as the backdrop, let's talk about Canton. Because I mean it when I say I think this is one of the most ambitious blockchain-led projects in the world. The problems you're trying to address, the problems you're trying to solve, I think are significant both in the non-blockchain way of running financial services systems and the blockchain way of identifying and managing financial services systems. So in your words, where did Canton come from? What was the inspiration behind it? And what is it that you're trying to change with this particular initiative?
So I might say a few things that are controversial.
I hope you do.
For people in the space. But I'll try to make them as coherent as possible. And I think that if you start with Bitcoin, the idea of Bitcoin was that in order to create a censorship resistance asset that has no issuer and have a limited supply, you needed to create a pseudo-anonymous privacy model. And that was very novel with Bitcoin. And I still think is very novel. And I think it's something to really admire. But the blockchain and the privacy model for Bitcoin was not a blockchain to create applications and not to create, you know, other use cases. It was really just to serve this one use case, which is Bitcoin, censorship resistance asset with limited supply, right? Like that was the use case. I think that what the problem, in my opinion, and this will give the context to how we thought about Canton, is that then came Ethereum, and Ethereum said, well, let's take exactly the same concept. Yes, there's account structure versus UTXO, but high level really did not change the idea that there's no privacy. All the miners get to see everything. They validate the transaction. And you also have one ledger to rule them all, meaning it's the world computer. And I think that there's a few challenges with that. Well, first of all, the idea that one ledger will be able to run the world, in my opinion, is just against the laws of physics. It just doesn't, it doesn't work. And I know that a lot of people will say, well, now it's the security layer for a lot of L2s. I still think that when you start actually looking at what does it mean to be the computer of the world, you can't just put it on one ledger. It's just not, in my opinion, physics will not support that. And that was one thing. The other thing, this idea that you need to have third-party infrastructure provider that get to see everything, they get to validate your transaction, from my perspective, is another concept that just doesn't really make sense. And we're just seeing kind of the outcomes of that. You know, there's this nice term. I like people know how to use words to make something look like what it's not. So miner extracted value sounds very sophisticated, sounds complicated. But if I came to you and I said, you know what, NASDAQ has a prop trading desk, and that prop trading desk, proprietary, I won't use shortcuts, but proprietary trading desk, can look at all the market activity that comes into their matching engine. And before they submit these packets into the matching engine, they can put their orders ahead of time. I mean, someone would sit in jail for that. Like if someone found something like that, you would be in jail, right? NASDAQ would cease to exist as a company. That would not be acceptable, not just to regulators. It would not be acceptable to anyone. If NASDAQ could see your transaction as Citadel or as Yuval trading on Robinhood or whatever, can see your transaction, can say, hold on, I'll just put my transaction ahead. And that's just one outcome of miners seeing your information. But just generally speaking, it means you don't have privacy. And when you look at the world, whether you like it or not, and this is where I'm trying to separate personal belief from just the reality of the world, it just won't work. Regulated institutions, proprietary institutions will just not operate where everybody can see all of the information that is related to their activity. It's a very similar argument that I say with to people that don't believe in Bitcoin or gold. I say, listen, as a trader, I just believe that there's enough people out there that do believe, and that's why I believe that there's going to be value to that asset. It doesn't matter if me personally believe in it or not. And
this
that's why
extrapolation of the everything is a Ponzi system belief, which I love using it as an example regularly enough because it forces people to think. You know, the American government is a Ponzi system, the dollar is a Ponzi system, gold is a Ponzi system, Bitcoin's a Ponzi system, your local farming cooperative is a Ponzi system. Literally everything is a Ponzi if you take it to literal definition. But suffice it to say, the flip of that is its network effect. If you get enough, if you get enough parties behind a system, if you create enough value within that system, it will be sustaining.
Exactly. I totally agree. So, you know, so if you take that, we said, well, to us, just those two things are fundamentally not going to work. Now, I do want to give the positives about the Ethereums and the likes of the world, all the smart contract platforms. And that will kind of lead into private chains or private blockchains that were created very early on, is I don't think that you can compete with user experience. And what I mean by that is this idea that you have a wallet or effectively a browser into a network, and I'm doing network on purpose, and you could access all applications on that network, to me is a user experience that you will never be able to compete with. And at the end of the day, we know that user experience wins. Right, so that's one thing. And I think this idea of composability that you get on these smart contract chains, I like composability more some people at Digital Asset will call it application interoperability, I think is another way to call it. Not to be mistaken with interoperability across chains. I don't want to talk about that just yet, but it's more the ability of two applications that have been created independently to be able to work with one another seamlessly, I think is a very, very powerful concept. And I think we took those two bad things, in our opinion, and two good things, and we said, well, how can you create a network that gives you the best of both worlds? And I think that negative is really what created private chains. Like, how do I have application and ownership and control? How can I control who can connect to me? And that's what led, you know, the birth of you know, Fabric, Corda, and some of these private chains. But I think that what they have failed to look at is this idea that at the end of the day, you could have a really good product, but if you have bad user experience around it, it will never succeed, right? And we've seen so many examples of that in history. And we try to think about, well, how can we change that? Like, that was really the concept. So Canton was born, and really the name Canton comes from, it was developed by our team in Switzerland. But there's also another nice meaning to it that, you know, Switzerland is one country, but it's actually built out of these cantons that have sovereignty, right? They have sovereignty, they have ability to create their own rules, they have their own tax regimes, but they all operate under this one country called Switzerland. So we thought it was a really nice gesture to the team in Switzerland that really worked hard developing it, but also kind of taking some of the ideas behind Canton. So really what Canton tried to do is to say, what is blockchain trying to do? Blockchain is trying to say, if there is a piece of information, how do you get verification that the people that are interested in that information all share the source of truth? And I think that what Canton said is, well, that depends on the application, not on the network. Right. So again, if you take Bitcoin, Bitcoin is an application. It's a use case. It's an asset class. And that use case says, well, all parties to the ledger need to know about this asset class, about all account balances in a pseudo-anonymous way. But Anthony, if you and I created an application to issue, you know, poker chips for our, you know, weekly poker game, well, it's just all that we care is that the eight players that play every week on a Sunday night would know about our account balances. The rest of the world doesn't need to know about it. And it's not even relevant if we care that they know about it, but just from an efficiency perspective, there's just no need for them to know about it, right? It doesn't provide any additional benefit. So just if you think from a data usage and network usage, it just creates a lot of traffic and a lot of information that really doesn't contribute to the mission that we're trying to do, which is making sure that we all agree on who has how many poker chips. And then you can take it even more to the extreme. And if you wanted to have some application around, you know, a doctor visit, and I'm taking it on purpose to something that we can all relate to, well, we don't want anyone to know about it other than ourselves and our doctor. So there you have a privacy level that you're saying, I just want it to be bilateral. And if you take just three examples that we gave very quickly here, well, what ends up happening is that today in public blockchains, the chain says, what is the privacy model? And you as an application need to figure out a way how to work with that privacy model. Well, this is where, in my opinion, Canton is very different than anything out there. Canton said, well, actually, you tell me what is your privacy model, and I will then enforce that privacy model. So rather than I am just going to come up with a very homogeneous privacy model, I'm going to say, well, the world is not homogeneous. It's actually very heterogeneous. And therefore, I need to be able to satisfy multiple privacy models, and you, the application, will define it. And I think that that exists also in the internet. So if you think about the internet, when you create a website, you could decide not to register that as part of DNS. Even if it's on DNS, you could say that you are like Craigslist. We're just a bulletin board. Everything here is public, or CNN. your privacy model is you want everybody to have access to all the information, or Wikipedia, or all of these websites, that their privacy model is there is no privacy. We want to be fully public. On the other hand, you have something like Chase.com, and Chase.com is to serve a bank. And a bank, whether we like it or not, is highly regulated, and they cannot offer their services to anyone who is not KYC'd AML. And therefore, you can land on Chase.com. You will see some informational material about Chase. You'll see maybe some information about where markets are today, you know, and things like that. But that's it. If you want to start accessing the actual service, which is the bank, you have to put in username and password, meaning you have to be allowed by the application provider to have access. And that's what we wanted to create with Canton, this ability to serve all these types of applications. But then taking it one step further, I think that we talked about application interoperability. So the reason why it's very easy, in our opinion, on public chains today to do composability and interoperability is because the privacy model is identical. And all of the assets, you know, ERC-20, big breakthrough for Ethereum, it just said, let's just normalize all these bearer instruments to be kind of like very simple and very, you know, so it's very easy to effectively do all the DeFi and all, you know, the decentralized exchanges just to exchange it, because they're all kind of identical bearer instruments that represent some other asset class. We said in Canton, well, how can we actually compose two applications that don't have the same privacy model? So imagine if you implemented USDC, so a stable coin that is pseudo-anonymous, meaning everybody can see account balances, but we can also implement the application of, like I said before, of a doctor. So now imagine that when I go to the doctor, I want to settle my transaction with the doctor using USDC. Well, now I have two applications that don't match from a privacy model. And really what Canton allows to do is you and I, Anthony, let's imagine you're my doctor, will actually be able to see on Canton a composed transaction of my doctor visit at your clinic and USDC as one transaction. And anybody else who's just a USDC holder would just see that money moved from one wallet to another and would have no idea what is the reason of that transaction. So you could actually honor the privacy model from both sides. And I can keep on going, but you know, high level to us, that's really the big change is really flipping it around. Rather than saying, here's a privacy model, figure out how you work with it, is actually saying, you, the application, define to us what is your privacy model, and the chain will enforce it for you.
Got you. So to summarize, I mean, some of the challenges we have with the existing financial system and ledger management, we've kind of established at the beginning of the show. In the kind of early evolution of some of the chains like Ethereum and Bitcoin, you have standardization, but they're designed to be universal ledgers. They're designed to be universal infrastructure that everybody has to follow the same rules for the most part. You then get into application design, application infrastructure, application management, and you're saying, okay, well, we'd like different applications will behave differently in regulated, unregulated industries, in information that should be made available for everybody to see, right? You want corporations to be transparent, but people want to preserve their privacy. Or, you know, there's even in B2B transactions, you're going to have some intellectual property or some elements of transaction details that you don't want people having the ability to correlate or having the ability to see. And so we need a mix of both ledger technology that people can trust to be scalable, automated, standardized to some extent, but we also need to have a degree of composability when it comes to the privacy and other elements of how the infrastructure works. And so put those things together and we get Canton.
Yeah, and I think you touched on something maybe that I didn't talk enough about, which is the scalability. And how do you solve for scalability with a user experience as well? So Canton does not assume that there's one universal ledger. Again, from the name Canton, there's many Cantons, right? So this idea of you have to be able to shard the problem, you have to be able to split the problem. So, you know, I give another example. If you use WhatsApp, you know, all you care within WhatsApp is that you have consensus and proper ordering within a message. You don't really care if there's consensus across messages. So you can think about every one of your messages as one of a canton, a canton, a canton, a canton. But so canton itself can shard the problem set. We call it domains. We don't call it L2s. We call it domains. So you can effectively have infinite amount of domains. But again, you want to have a user experience that when I connect to the network, I still feel like I'm connecting to one global network. Very similar to the internet. The internet is not one network. It's actually many networks that use internet protocols to communicate with one another and to create a seamless experience that when you log with the browser, you feel you're connecting to one network. So very similar with Canton, a Canton client node, effectively your wallet, can connect to the Canton network as one entry point. You could feel like you're working with one network, but it is actually sharding the problem. And this is where I think the challenge, when you look at all the L2s, in order to compose a transaction across multiple L2s, you effectively have to go down to the mainnet to coordinate that transaction, which makes it very expensive and very slow. In Canton, you could actually coordinate a transaction directly between domains. So that's where we believe also it's not just application composability, it's also how do you do L2 composability, which is a very big challenge. And again, from a user experience perspective, we don't expect the user to think about, well, how do I break the sharding? Because, you know, in Polygon and some of these other chains, you need to explicitly create another L2. You have to explicitly create it. And maybe for very simple use cases, that works. But when you start trying to think about, well, how do I build a syndicated loan that has so many different states with so many different privacy levels that change dynamically as the problem gets more and more complicated throughout the life cycle of an asset, you realize that the big O problem or the complex science perspective becomes unmanageable by a human. So again, for us, the idea of creating these different domains of privacy is something that has to be dynamically managed by the chain, not by the developer. So all that the developer is modeling is what is the state at the moment and who are the stakeholders to this state. And it's the chain underneath that is going to manage all the sharding of that problem.
Got you. And I'm glad you started to come onto the participants, because I think this is the most interesting part of any decentralized network is how you create that scale. How do you create network effect? How do you encourage innovation? I think a lot of early stage layer ones and even some of the layer twos are so complex or require such effort from a developer's perspective to learn domain-specific programming languages or to have an SDK or integrations that are just either too complicated or for enterprises or banks even are just too much like hard work. Enterprises today want to consume software as a service. You talked about the user experience challenge. Oftentimes being able to deploy new software should be as close to the existing stack as possible. If there's a requirement for specific domain languages, if there's requirements for unfamiliar, untested technology with no SLAs, you're going to have challenges in enterprise adoption. And as much as we would like decentralized technology to scale with the 100,000 angry degens on crypto Twitter, the reality is that this technology will scale best if it's put in the hands of those organizations that intermediate or that facilitate transactions of money and data, because that's what as human beings we do the most of, right? So if this is technology that's designed to help humans, put it where data and money flow, and that's kind of where you guys are.
Yeah, absolutely. And I mean, I will tell you, Canton and generally speaking, our stack has a long way to go to make that user experience as seamless as you talk about. I think what we have been really trying to think is, as a former developer, I would definitely not call myself a developer today. You know, when you think about the role of, so I started as a C++ developer. And when you think about it, well, that's very good for high frequency trading because you have much closer interaction with the hardware, much more control of the machine. But 95% of applications, probably even higher in the world, do not require that kind of familiarity with hardware. And that's why Java became so popular, is because it created all of this abstraction that you as a developer don't need to worry yourself with that complexity. We thought about when we created DAML, our smart contract language, in Canton, as kind of a similar idea, is Well, if you're now moving to saying, I'm going to manage a distributed system, well, the amount of variables that you need to control to get that right becomes significantly more complicated. So the first thing that we try to do is how to abstract that complexity of managing privacy, all of those things that we talked about right now by the developer, and try to create a much more abstracted interaction for the developer. It does require, you know, rethinking about how do I model things? Because if you are a developer who have been building applications that were centralized for the last 20 years, it does require a change in paradigm of how to think about application architecture and a lot of things. And I think that we can still be doing a lot more to improve that, but that's kind of where we came from. So we started by saying, like, if you're just going to create something that allows the developer to control all of these variables, it will never scale because it will just become so complicated so quick that it would not be feasible to build really large scale applications. We solved that problem. That was early on. We're now very focused exactly about the things you said: deployment of application, monitoring of applications, you know, availability, scalability. There's just so much still that we can do. But that was kind of our starting point, how we started, and there's a lot more to do.
DevEx experience work never ends, and things always have versions, and things always require updates, and the journey never finishes. I want to talk specifically about the ecosystem now. So people who are kind of used to closed applications will know that the ecosystem is their enterprise, their bank, maybe some of the trading partners that are also using that proprietary software. When it comes to blockchain networks, you've got a slightly different approach. You've got the users of applications, you've got the developers of decentralized applications, you've got validators, you've got the developers of the protocol itself who are stakeholders. You've then got investors in any number of those different parties. And the more activity that you foster across all of those different points of the network, the more successful the network will become. And that by design in blockchain networks is open. Open source. Anybody, for the most part, can host a node. There are some requirements around, particularly with proof of stake, where you need to have a certain amount of stake to start being a validator. But suffice it to say, it's relatively open. Compared to those architectures, how do we create or how do we scale Canton as an ecosystem?
Yeah, great question. So I'll break the question into two parts. So I'll start with the part where you talk about open source, everybody. We actually believe that from a consensus or how you run it, Canton is probably more open than most open networks in the sense that anybody can be a validator on Canton, everybody can be a participant, and there is no proof of stake or proof of work that, from a game theory perspective, at the end of the day, they are going to become monopolies at the end of the day. I don't think that you can avoid that. You will have some kind of concentration. In Canton, it's can you actually prove that you have value to the network? And you prove it by saying that as a validator, you're providing validation for free, or you have better SLAs as a validator. You're doing a lot of things, but there's nothing that prevents. Canton is open source, DAML is open source, the whole stack is open source, and everybody can be a validator. That being said, and this is maybe the second part of my answer, is that I truly believe that at the end of the day, any network that doesn't provide true real world utility value is going to fail eventually. I can't tell you how long, but it will eventually fail. I think the world is efficient in the sense that people do move to value. And value could also be short-term entertainment. The problem with entertainment is if you can't feed the machine, eventually it will stop, right? And I think you've seen in crypto plenty of those short-term ideas that got a lot of interest, a lot of excitement. And as fast as they exploded, they died. And
I
think that...
I'm going to compliment you on taking what is a kind of fairly well-known term of pump and dump and turning it into short-term ideas. I think that's a much kinder way of describing them.
Yeah, because I think that that term includes bad motivation, but it also includes good motivations, right? I mean, you know, I think a lot of people bash crypto and the risk and everything, and at the same time don't talk about AI at the same breath. I mean, every technology, 3D printing could be really good for printing organs, and it could also print weapons. I mean, you could think about every technology and give me most technologies, and I'll be able to think about good usages of them and bad. So the reason I kind of put it into that nice category is that I think that it's much more in line with what I was trying to talk about. A short-term idea is something that doesn't have long-term utility. And therefore, the short-term could have been for bad reasons, nefarious reasons, but also could have been for good reasons, right? And whether you like it or not, I think that if you can't prove long-term value, things will die eventually. And the reason I brought that up is when we started Canton, I mean, Canton was actually available already in 2020. The reason we announced it only now is because we actually wanted to show long-term utility running on Canton before we make it public to the world. And that's why when we announced it, there were like, I think, I don't know, 30, 35 entities on the announcement, because they've been using it already for 2 years. So for us, I'm not going to say that NFTs are necessarily a bad idea or a short-term idea. I think that the way they were used, in my opinion, didn't have long-term utility. But I think the idea of an immutable asset on a public chain is a very good idea. So, you know, we're using, I'm not going to say NFTs because we don't call it NFTs, but the same concept of NFTs around, for example, data leakage. Can you actually solve data leakage and royalty payments around data on a public chain? Very good use case, in my opinion. And it is actually a problem that exists in the industry. Collateral management, only 25% of eligible collateral in the world gets used. And I'm going to use a lot of examples that are in financial services, but life insurance, to create a new life insurance product and actually take it to market takes about 6 to 9 months. We think that you can drop that. We think that you can remove massive amounts of reconciliation in the insurance space. Sports wagering. I mean, there's so many different industries. So what we've been thinking about is really trying to be not focus on short-term revenue, but really focus on business ideas that, in our opinion, will have long-term viability. And as a result of that, what will end up happening is you will build the network, not as fast as other networks have been built, but I think it will be very steady. And I have a funny story. We've actually talked to a company that does, you know, game theory analysis of how networks will grow. And when they looked at Canton and how we take it to market, they said, oh, you're going to have a very slow, steady growth over time. But they said it in a negative context. And when we said that that was the outcome, we said, we're very happy with it. That's exactly what we want. And I said, oh, most of the people that come to us really want to see a hockey stick on day one. And I was like, well, but that's just not realistic, in my opinion. It takes time to build value that is long-term sustainable. And I just don't think that there are any shortcuts in order to do that.
I would agree. When it comes to, if you're talking about real digital transformation, if you're talking about actually embedding new technology and established processes, I can't think of a single one, save for maybe the advent of the application on the smartphone, that so quickly changed the paradigm or so quickly changed the deployment model of workflows in software. And we sort have of,
yeah,
mobility.
Take cloud.
20% now?
Not everybody's using cloud. Exactly.
So we've still got
a journey to go there. That to me is like crazy, right? It's crazy, like that number. But it's the reality that those type of things takes a long time. But I think that cloud have proven its value a long time ago. It just takes time for that network to grow and that utility to grow.
And because some people are fearful, some contracts are embedded for a long time for on-premise. The idea of people putting data in a cloud is particularly for IP. That is a philosophical belief for some. Whether the technology benefits case stacks up or not, some people will fundamentally say, until I can see the bare metal machine sat underneath my office where I know my data is and it's there and I can touch it, that I'm not going to run my business any other way. And you know, that's a journey that will, again, that will go on forever. There will be people who are in the bare metal camp and will always be. I think somebody told me the other day that IBM has never sold more of its on-prem servers in the last year than ever. It's had a record sales year for on-prem, which is, I mean, I'm delighted for them. I don't hold any IBM stock anymore, but I mean, I'm delighted for them to be successful in the market. But back to the point around digital transformation being hard, slow, and it's a slog. I do want to just briefly touch on the constituents, though, of Canton. So some of the actors that came out in the press release were some of the major banks, systems integrators, exchanges that are kind of well-known brands. I'm interested also then in the validators or the software providers or the innovators who will come to Canton and bring additional value. What's your vision around that? Because in the white paper, that was the bit that caught my interest, right? There isn't a token. There's no MEV in this. There's no opportunity to be rewarded in tokens that will then someday appreciate as the network grows. So the traditional incentive model, albeit a simplistic one for validators, isn't there with Canton. So how are you guys going to do that slow and steady?
Yeah. So first of all, I will say there is no token in Canton yet. Is maybe what I will say. I think that, and if there were ever to be, there will never be a model in Canton where a miner must charge you gas or the equivalent for a transaction. Again, Canton doesn't believe in a binary world where everything is either a yes or a no, right? So if there were ever to be a coin in Canton, it would be that it is a utility asset across the network, and it is the miners or the validators' right to force you to use it, but then you don't have to go to those miners and validators. You could go to those that offer you to pay in US dollars once a month. I mean, I think that that's just critical. Again, like we don't want to create effectively a financial instrument or something like that that has an inherent conflict of interest with the network. I just generally speaking think that you either want a network to allow things to grow organically or you want to force it. And we're not trying to force anything. That's one comment that I would make. I think that's why I said that it's really important that the people that are building the network see value from the network by itself, and anything else is an added value. So the miners that currently exist on Canton are those that are providing applications. They want the network to succeed. So when Broadridge runs Repo, they want Repo to succeed. They want, you know, to take, you know, 100% of the US repo market and for it to go through their service. That is their primary goal. That's why they want Canton to succeed. That's why they're running some of the infrastructure. And to me, that's the best motivation. They're not motivated by a speculative asset, whether, you know, that is not core to their business, right? So we actually wanted to take partners and customers that see direct ROI from the network being successful as a network.
Which is a materially different way of talking about it than I think most people would say. It's we are building a network and software. We want it to be the best, that it will be maintained or developed by those who have a stake in it succeeding or who believe in our philosophy for how financial services infrastructure should scale or the next generation of financial services infrastructure.
And then if there was a coin or something like that, that to me is cream on top of that, right? It's like, it's an added value. But I think that can potentially flip in the future, that the coin suddenly becomes such an important asset, but that's only after you prove that the network has value, not the other way around. And I think that's the problem, you know, about short-term ideas, is someone comes up with a white paper, comes with a proof, with a promise, we're going to deliver. I mean, I can tell you, we looked at Aptos at one point and their numbers on throughput and everything. And then we posted a question on their bulletin board. And the response was, oh yeah, that throughput that we talked about years away. Right, so kind of put something out there and everybody buys in where the network itself didn't even prove itself.
Theoretical, right? Transaction and throughput is not a strong statement to make.
And I think that when you look at how companies build, I mean, you raise value, you have a lower valuation, you prove yourself, you advance, you get a higher valuation. I mean, that's how, you know, the world works. And I think this idea of short-term gains on just promises, we've seen how that ends with the dot-com, right? And I don't think it's any different. I mean, if you look at most coins, most investors that invested in them have lost their money, right? And I think that what I would want to see is a world where, you know, we get measured against what we actually deliver, what the network actually deliver. And I think that, first of all, what we're trying to do is prove the value of the network, that the people that operate on the network actually derive value out of it. And then, sure, attach an asset to the network or not, to me, is more something that has to be built on the proofs of the network.
I think it's a fair call. And then when you get to that point, you'll be doing it from an objective standpoint in saying there are parts of this network that need to have a native token because we want to have a shared incentive, or we want to use this for the equivalent of a share or a stock type component in the network, or we want to have some sort of revenue sharing or monetary vehicle in this that isn't a stable coin that we can already introduce, or that isn't the US dollar or euro or yen or whatever established fiat vehicle we might want to have, or that the having of a digital asset native to this platform allows us to unlock other use cases that at the moment we can't do because
you're spot on. I mean, I couldn't have said what you just said better. And I think that I don't want my comments to be taken out of context that I think tokens of a smart contract chain is a bad thing. I think it's a very novel idea of how to share, distribute wealth due to value creators. I actually think it's a very, very good idea and something that can provide value, but no different than if you look at airline miles. If I just offered you, not trying to be offensive to Kazakhstan, but Air Kazakhstan air miles versus, I don't know, Qatar Airlines, we're pretty sure I know which one you will choose, right? And the reason is because you're saying that network offers me much more utility for that value of the asset. So this idea of native assets to networks have been existing for a very long time and have been used many different ways to motivate positive behavior or behavior that is good for the network, and then distributing value back to those that support the network. So I'm super positive about that, but it has to come from a point where you have shown that you can create value to the constituents of the network beyond just speculative financial investment.
And on that bombshell, we will end the show. Yuval, thank you so much for taking us through Canton. Thank you for taking us through the logic. Some really useful, really insightful, plain English or plain language definitions that I want everyone to take away from this, because I think the more you talk to people who are doing genuine digital transformation with decentralized technology, the more you get relatable examples that actually are sustainable or that will persist. That is technology that will change the world, not because blockchain, but because the people who are behind it understand how change can be made. And also not to assume that we can't break the orthodoxies of the way things work today, that we can't re-engineer organizations, we can't re-engineer industries, but that's even harder to do than try to re-engineer companies. And that will come too. But in the meantime, we have Canton, we have Ethereum, we have Bitcoin, we have other systems like the ones that we work on at Midnight. There's plenty going on, and there's plenty of people out there who are trying to create utility, not short-term ideas. So good luck on your continued journey. Thank you for taking time with us here on the show, and stay safe out there.
No, thank you. Thank you for having me. I appreciate it. Take care.
Thanks again for listening to the Blockchain Won't Save the World podcast. As always, opinions in this episode are mine and those of my guests alone. If you want to find out more, please feel free to connect with me on LinkedIn. Check out some of the other episodes on the Blockchain Won't Save the World podcast, and check out the YouTube channel, also called Blockchain Won't Save the World. Stay safe out there.